The Gulag Archipelago, Volume 1, Section 2, continued.
Cassette 7, Side 1.
According to the calculations of non-prisoner engineers, 6 people can sit on the bottom bunks of a Stolypin compartment, and another 3 can lie on the middle ones, which are joined in one continuous bunk, except for the space cut out beside the door for climbing up and getting down. And 2 more can lie on the baggage shelves above. Now, if, in addition to these 11 more are pushed into the compartment, the last of whom are shoved out of the way of the door by the jailer's boots as they shut it, then this will constitute a normal complement for a Stolypin prisoner's compartment. 2 huddle, half sitting on each of the upper baggage shelves, another 5 lie on the joined middle level, and they are the lucky ones. These places are won in battle, and if there are any prisoners present from the underworld companionship of thieves, the Blatnye, then it is they who are lying there. And this leaves 13 down below. 5 sit on each of the bunks, and 3 are in the aisle between their legs. Somewhere, mixed up with the people, on the people and under the people, are their belongings. And that is how they sit, their crossed legs wedged beneath them day after day. No, it isn't done especially to torture people. A sentenced prisoner is a laboring soldier of socialism, so why should he be tortured? They need him for construction work. But after all, you will agree he is not often a jaunt to visit his mother-in-law, and there's no reason in the world to treat him so well that people out in freedom would envy him. We have problems with our transportation. He'll get there all right, and he won't die on the way either. Since the 50s, when railroad timetables were actually straightened out, the prisoners haven't had to travel in this fashion for very long at a time, say, a day and a half or 2 days. During and after the war, things were worse. From Petropavlovsk, in Kazakhstan, to Karaganda, a Stolypin car might be 7 days en route, with 25 people in a compartment. From Karaganda to Sverdlovsk, it could be 8 days, with up to 26 in a compartment. Even just going from Kuibyshev to Chelyabinsk in August 1945, Susi travelled in a Stolypin car for several days, and their compartment held 35 people lying on top of one another, floundering, fighting. Does this perhaps satisfy those who are astonished and reproachful because people didn't fight? And in the autumn of 1946, Envy Timofeyev Resovsky travelled from Petropavlovsk to Moscow in a compartment that had 36 people in it. For several days he hung, suspended between other human beings, and his legs did not touch the floor. Then they started to die off, and the guards hauled the corpses out from under their feet. Not right away, true, only on the second day. That way things became less crowded. The whole trip to Moscow continued in this fashion for 3 weeks. When he got to Moscow, a miracle took place in accordance with the laws of the country of miracles. Officers carried Timofeyev Resovsky from the prisoner transport in their arms, and he was driven away in an ordinary automobile. He was off to advance science. Was 36 the upper limit for a Stolypin compartment? I have no evidence available on 37 or higher. And yet, adhering to our one and only scientific method, and remembering the necessity to struggle against the limiters, we are compelled to reply, no, 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 it is not a limit. Perhaps in some other country it would be an upper limit, but not here. As long as there are any cubic centimetres of unbreathed air left in the compartment, even if it be beneath the upper shelves, even if between shoulders, legs and heads, the compartment is ready to take additional prisoners. One might, however, conditionally accept as the upper limit the number of unremoved corpses which can be contained in the total volume of the compartment, given the possibility of packing them in at leisure. V. A. Korneyeva travelled from Moscow in a compartment that held 30 women, most of them withered old women exiled for their religious beliefs. On arrival, all these women, except 2, were immediately put in the hospital. Nobody died in the compartment because several of the prisoners were young, well-developed, good-looking girls arrested for going out with foreigners. These girls took it upon themselves to shame the convoy. You ought to be ashamed to transport them this way. These are your own mothers. It probably wasn't so much their moral argument as their attractive appearance. which produced a reaction in the convoy guards, and they did move several of the old women out to the punishment cell. But the punishment cell in the Stolypin car is no punishment. It is a blessing. Of 5 prisoner compartments, 4 are used as general cells, and the 5th is set aside and divided in 2 halves. 2 narrow half compartments, with 1 lower and 1 upper berth, like those the conductors have. These punishment cells serve to isolate prisoners. 3 or 4 travel in them at a time, and this gives both comfort and space. No, it is not intentionally to torture them with thirst that the exhausted and overcrowded prisoners are fed not soup, but salt herring or dry smoked Caspian carp for the whole of their trip in the Stolypin car. This was exactly how it was in all the years, the 30s and the 50s, winter and summer, in Siberia and the Ukraine, and it isn't even necessary to cite examples. It was not to torture them with thirst, but just you tell me what these ragamuffins were to be fed anyway while being moved around. They were not supposed to get hot meals in prisoner transport railroad cars. True, there was a kitchen in one of the Stolypin car compartments, but that was only for the convoy. You couldn't just give the prisoners raw grits, and you couldn't give them raw codfish either, nor could you give them canned meat because they might stuff themselves. Herring was just the thing, with a piece of bread. And what else did they need? Go ahead, take your half a herring while they're handing it out, and be glad you got it. If you're smart, you aren't going to eat that herring. Just be patient, wait, hide it in your pocket, and you can eat it at the next transit point when there is water to be had. It's worse when they issue wet Sea of Azov anchovies covered with coarse salt. You can't keep them in your pocket, so scoop them up in the flaps of your pea jacket or in your handkerchief in the palm of your hand, and eat them. They divide up these Azov anchovies on somebody's pea jacket, whereas the convoy guards dump the dried carp right on the floor of the compartment, and it is divided up on the benches on the prisoner's knees. P.F. Yakubovich, in The World of the Outcasts, Volume 1, Moscow, 1964, writing about the 90s of the last century, recounts that in those terrible years they gave out 10 kopecks a day mess money per person in Siberian prisoner transports, when the price of a loaf of wheat bread, weighing 10.5 ounces, was 5 kopecks, a pot of milk, 2 quarts, 3 kopecks. The prisoners were simply in clover, he writes. But then, in Irkutsk province, the prices were higher. A pound of meat cost 10 kopecks there, and the prisoners were simply famished. 1 pound of meat per day per person. It's not half a herring, is it? But once they've given you a fish, they aren't going to hold back on the bread, and maybe they'll even throw in a bit of sugar. Things are much worse when the convoy comes over and announces, "We aren't going to be feeding you today. Nothing was issued for you." And it could very well be that nothing was actually issued. Someone in one or another prison accounting office made a mistake in the figures. And it could also be that it was issued, but that the convoy was short on rations. After all, they aren't exactly overfed either. And so they decided to snag a bit of your bread for themselves, and in that case to hand over half a herring by itself would seem suspicious. And, of course, it is not for the purpose of intentionally torturing the prisoner that after his herring he is given neither hot water, and he never gets that here in any case, nor even plain unboiled water. One has to understand the situation. The convoy staff is limited. Some of them have to be on watch in the corridor. Some are on duty on the platform. At the stations, they clamber all over the car, under it, on top of it, to make sure that there aren't any holes in it. Others are kept busy cleaning guns, and then, of course, there has to be time for political indoctrination and their catechism on the Articles of War. And the third shift is sleeping. They insist on their full 8 hours, for after all, the war is over. And then, to go carry water in pails, it has to be hauled a long way, too, and it's insulting. Why should a Soviet soldier have to carry water like a donkey for enemies of the people? And there are also times when they spend half a day hauling the Stolypin cars way out from the station in order to reshuffle or recouple the cars. It will be farther away from prying eyes. And the result is that you can't get water even for your own Red Army mess. True, there is one way out. You can go dip up some water from the locomotive tender. It's yellow and murky with some lubricating grease mixed in with it. But the Zeks will drink it willingly. It doesn't really matter that much anyway. since it isn't as if they could see what they are drinking in the semi-darkness of their compartment. They don't have their own window, and there isn't any light bulb there either, and what light they get comes from the corridor. And there's another thing, too. It takes a long time to dole out that water. The Zecs don't have their own mugs. Whoever did have one has had it taken away from him. So what it adds up to is that they have to be given the 2 government-issue mugs to drink out of, and while they're drinking up, you have to keep standing there and standing and dipping it out and dipping it out some more and handing it to them. Yes, and then, too, the prisoners argue about who's to drink first. They want the healthy prisoners to drink first, and only then those with tuberculosis, and last of all, those with syphilis. Just as if it wasn't going to begin all over again in the next cell. First, the healthy ones. But the convoy could have borne with all that, hauled the water, and doled it out, if only those pigs, after slurping up the water, didn't ask to go to the toilet. So here's the way it all works out. If you don't give them water for a day, then they don't ask to go to the toilet. Give them water once, and they go to the toilet once. Take pity on them and give them water twice, and they go to the toilet twice. So it's pure and simple common sense. Just don't give them anything to drink. And it isn't that one is stingy about taking them to the toilet because one wants to be stingy about the use of the toilet itself, but because taking prisoners to the toilet is a responsible, even one might say a combat operation. It takes a long, long time for one private first class and 2 privates. 2 guards have to be stationed, one next to the toilet door, the other in the corridor on the opposite side, so that no one tries to escape in that direction, while the private first class has to push open and then shut the door to the compartment, first to admit the returning prisoner, and then to allow the next one out. The statutes permit letting out only one at a time, so that they don't try to escape, and so that they can't start a rebellion. Therefore, the way it works out is that the one prisoner who has been let out to go to the toilet is holding up 30 others in his own compartment, and 120 in the whole car, not to mention the convoy detail. And so the command resounds, "Come on there, come on, get a move on, get a move on." The private first class and the soldiers keep hurrying him all the way there and back, and he hurries so fast that he stumbles, and it's as though they think he is going to steal that shithole from the state. In 1949, travelling in a Stolypin car between Moscow and Kuibyshev, the one-legged German Schultz, having understood the Russian hurry-up by this time, jumped to the toilet and back on his one leg, while the convoy kept laughing and ordering him to go faster. During one such trip, one of the convoy guards pushed him when he reached the platform at the end of the corridor, and Schultz fell down on the floor in front of the toilet. The convoy guard went into a rage and began to beat him, while Schultz, who couldn't get up because of the blows raining down on him, crawled and crept into the dirty toilet. The rest of the convoy roared with laughter. This, it seems, is what is meant by the phrase, Stalin's cult of personality. So that the prisoner shouldn't attempt to escape during the moment he was in the toilet, and also for a faster turnaround, the door to the toilet was not closed, and the convoy guard, watching the process from the platform of the car, could encourage it. "Come on, come on now, that's plenty, that's enough for you." Sometimes the orders came before you even started. "All right, number one only." And that meant that from the platform they'd prevent you doing anything else. And then, of course, you couldn't wash your hands. There was never enough water in the tank there, and there wasn't enough time either. If the prisoner even so much as touched the plunger of the washstand, the convoy guard would roar, "Don't you touch that! Move along!" And if someone happened to have soap or a towel among his belongings, he wouldn't dare take it out anyway, simply out of shame. That would really be acting like a sucker. The toilet was filthy. "Quicker! Quicker!" And tracking back the liquid mess on his shoes, the prisoner would be shoved back into the compartment, where he would climb up over somebody's arms and shoulders, and then from the top row his dirty shoes would dangle to the middle row and drip. When women were taken to the toilet, the statutes of the convoy service, and common sense as well, required that the toilet door be kept open, but not every convoy insisted on this, and some allowed the door to be shut. "Oh, all right, go ahead and shut it." Later on, one of the women was sent in to wash out the toilet, and the guard again had to stand right there beside her so that she didn't try to escape. And even at this fast tempo, visits to the toilet for 120 people would take more than 2 hours. more than a quarter of the entire shift for three convoy guards. And in spite of that, you still couldn't make them happy. In spite of that, some old sandpiper or other would begin to cry half an hour later and ask to go to the toilet, and of course he wouldn't be allowed to go, and then he would soil himself right there in the compartment. And once again, that meant trouble for the private first class. The prisoner had to be forced to pick it up in his hands and carry it away. So, that was all there was to it. Fewer trips to the toilet. And that meant less water and less food, too, because then they wouldn't complain of loose bowels and stink up the air. After all, how bad could it be? A man couldn't even breathe. Less water. But they had to hand out the herring anyway, just as the regulations required. No water. That was a reasonable measure. No herring. That was a service crime. No one at all, ever set out to torture us on purpose. The convoy's actions were quite reasonable, but like the ancient Christians, we sat there in the cage while they poured salt on our raw and bleeding tongues. Also, the prisoner transport convoys did not often deliberately, though sometimes they did, mix the thieves, blattari, and non-political offenders in with Article 58 politicals in the same compartment. But a particular situation existed. There were a great many prisoners and very few railroad cars and compartments, and time was always short. And so when was there time enough to sort them out? One of the four compartments was kept for women, and if the prisoners in the other three were to be sorted out on one basis or another, the most logical basis would be by destination, so that it would be easier to unload them. After all, was it because Pontius Pilate wanted to humiliate him that Christ was crucified between two thieves? It just happened to be crucifixion day that day, and there was only one Golgotha, and time was short, and so he was numbered with the transgressors. I am afraid even to think what I would have had to suffer if I had been in the position of a common convict. The convoy and the transport officers dealt with me and my comrades with cautious politeness. Being a political, I went to hard labour in relative comfort. On the transports, I had quarters separate from the criminal prisoners, and my pood, my 36 pounds of baggage, was moved about on a cart. I left out the quotation marks around the above paragraph to enable the reader to understand things a little better. After all, quotation marks are always used either for irony or to set something apart. And without quotation marks, the paragraph sounds wild, does it not? It was written by P.F. Yakubovich, about the 90s of the last century. His book was recently republished as a sermon on that dark and dismal age. We learn from it that even on a barge, the political prisoners had special quarters and a special section set aside for their walks on deck. The same thing appears in Tolstoy's Resurrection, in which, furthermore, an outsider, Prince Nekhludov, is allowed to visit the political prisoners in order to interview them. And it was only because the magic word political had been left out by mistake, opposite Yakubovich's name on the list, his own words, that he was met at Ust-Kara by the hard labour inspector, like an ordinary criminal prisoner, rudely, provocatively, impudently. However, this misunderstanding was all happily cleared up. What an unbelievable time! It was almost a crime to mix politicals with criminals. Criminals were teamed up and driven along the streets to the station so as to expose them to public disgrace. And politicals could go there in carriages. Olminsky in 1899. Politicals were not fed from the common pot, but were given a food allowance instead, and had their meals brought from public eating houses. The Bolshevik Olminsky didn't want even the hospital rations because he found the food too coarse. Because of all of this, the ordinary criminal mob christened the professional revolutionaries mangy swells, P.F. Yakubovich. The Butyrki prison superintendent apologized to Olminsky for the jailers having addressed him too familiarly. You see, we seldom get politicals here, and the jailer didn't know any better. Seldom get politicals in the Butyrki? What kind of dream is this? Then where were they? The Lubyanka didn't exist as a prison at the time, and neither did Lefortovo. The writer Radishchev was taken to the prisoner transport in shackles, and when the weather got cold, they threw over him a repulsive, raw sheepskin coat, which they had taken from a watchman. However, the Empress Catherine immediately issued orders that his shackles be removed and that he be provided with everything he required for his journey. But in November 1927, Anna Skridnikova was sent on a transport from the Butyrki to the Solovetsky Islands in a straw hat and a summer dress. That was what she had been wearing when she was arrested in the summer, and since that time her room had been sealed, and no one was willing to give her permission to get her winter things out of it. To draw a distinction between political prisoners and common criminals is the equivalent of showing them respect as equal opponents, of recognizing that people may have views of their own. Thus, a political prisoner is conscious of political freedom, even when under arrest. But since the time when we all became KRs and the socialists failed to retain their status as politicals, since then, any protest that as a political you ought not to be mixed up with ordinary criminals has resulted only in laughter on the prisoner's part and bewilderment on the part of the jailers. "All are criminals here," the jailers reply, sincerely. This mingling, this first devastating encounter, takes place either in the Black Maria or in the Stolypin car. Up to this moment, no matter how they have oppressed, tortured, and tormented you during the interrogation, it has all originated with the Blue Caps, and you have never confused them with human beings, but have seen in them merely an insolent branch of the service. But at the same time, even if your cellmates have been totally different from you in development and experience, and even if you have quarreled with them, and even if they have squealed on you, they have all belonged to that same ordinary, sinful, everyday humanity among which you have spent your whole life. When you were jammed into a Stolypin compartment, you expected that here, too, you would encounter only colleagues in misfortune. All your enemies and oppressors remained on the other side of the bars, and you certainly did not expect to find them on this side. And suddenly you lift your eyes to the square recess in the middle bunk, to that one and only heaven above you, and up there you see three or four, oh no, not faces. They aren't monkey muzzles either, because monkeys' muzzles are much, much decenter and more thoughtful. No, and they aren't simply hideous countenances, since there must be something human even in them. You see cruel, loathsome snouts up there, wearing expressions of greed and mockery. Each of them looks at you like a spider gloating over a fly. Their web is that grating which imprisons you, and you have been had. They squinch up their lips, as if they intend to bite you from one side. They hiss when they speak, enjoying that hissing more than the vowel and consonant sounds of speech. And the only thing about their speech that resembles the Russian language is the endings of verbs and nouns. It is gibberish. Those strange gorilloids were usually dressed in sleeveless undershirts. After all, it is stuffy in the Stolypin car. Their sinewy purple necks, their swelling shoulder muscles, their swarthy tattooed chests have never suffered prison emaciation. Who are they? Where do they come from? And suddenly you see a small cross dangling from one of those necks. Yes, a little aluminum cross on a string. You are surprised and slightly relieved. That means there are religious believers among them. How touching. So nothing terrible is going to happen. But immediately this believer belies both his cross and his faith by cursing, and they curse partly in Russian, and he jabs two protruding fingers spread into the V of a slingshot right in your eyes, not even pausing to threaten you, but starting to punch them out then and there. And this gesture of theirs, which says, "I'll gouge out your eyes, crowbait," covers their entire philosophy and faith. If they are capable of crushing your eyeballs like worms, what is there on you or belonging to you that they'll spare? The little cross dangles there, and your still unsquashed eyes watch this wildest of masquerades, and your whole system of reckoning goes awry. Which of you is already crazy, and who is about to go insane? In one moment, all the customs and habits of human intercourse you have lived with all your life have broken down. In your entire previous life, particularly before your arrest, but even to some degree afterward, even to some degree during interrogation, too, you spoke words to other people, and they answered you in words, and those words produced actions. One might persuade, or refuse, or come to an agreement. You recall various human relationships, a request, an order, an expression of gratitude. But what has overtaken you here is beyond all these words and beyond all these relationships. An emissary of the ugly snout descends, most often a vicious boy whose impudence and rudeness are thrice despicable. And this little demon unties your bag and rifles your pockets, not tentatively, but treating them like his very own. From that moment, nothing that belongs to you is yours any longer. And all you yourself are is a rubber dummy around which superfluous things are wrapped, which can easily be taken off. Nor can you explain anything in words, nor deny, nor prohibit, nor plead with that evil little skunk or those foul snouts up above. They are not people. This has become clear to you in one moment. The only thing to be done with them is to beat them without wasting any time flapping your tongue. Either that juvenile there or those bigger vermin up above. But how can you hit those three up top from down below? And the kid there, even though he's a stinking polecat, well, it doesn't seem right to hit him either. Maybe you can push him away, soft-like. No, you can't even do that, because he'll bite your nose right off, or else they'll break your head from above. And they have knives, too, but they aren't going to bother to pull them out and soil them on you. You look at your neighbors, your comrades. Let's either resist or protest. But all your comrades, all your fellow Article 58s, who have been plundered one by one even before you got there, sit there submissively, hunched over, and they stare right past you. And it's even worse when they look at you the way they always do look at you, as though no violence were going on at all, no plundering, as though it were a natural phenomenon, as though it were the grass growing and the rain falling. And the reason why, gentlemen, comrades, and brothers, is that the proper time was allowed to slip by. You ought to have got hold of yourselves and remembered who you were back when Straczynski burned himself alive in the Wiatka cell, and even before that, when you were declared counter-revolutionaries. And so you allow the thieves to take your overcoat and paw through your jacket and snatch your 20 rubles from where it was sewn in, and your bag has already been tossed up above and checked out, and everything your sentimental wife collected for your long trip after you were sentenced stays up there, and they've thrown the bag back down to you with your toothbrush. Although not everyone submitted just like that, 99% did in the 30s and 40s. I have heard of a few cases in which three seasoned, young, and healthy men stood up against the thieves, not to defend justice in general, but to protect not those who were being plundered right next to them, but themselves only. In other words, armed neutrality. And how could that be? Men, officers, soldiers, front-line soldiers. To strike out boldly, a person has to be ready for that battle, waiting for it, and has to understand its purpose. All these conditions were absent here. A person wholly unfamiliar with the thieves, the Blatnoi milieu, didn't anticipate this battle, and most importantly, failed totally to understand its vital necessity. Up to this point, he had assumed, incorrectly, that his only enemies were the blue caps. He needed still more education to arrive at the understanding that the tattooed chests were merely the rear ends of the blue caps. This was the revelation that blue caps never utter aloud. You today, me tomorrow. The new prisoner wanted to consider himself a political, in other words, on the side of the people, while the state was against the people. And at that point he was unexpectedly assaulted from behind and both sides by quick-fingered devils of some kind, and all the categories got mixed up, and clarity was shattered into fragments. And it would take a long time for the prisoner to put two and two together and figure out that this horde of devils were hand in glove with the jailers. To strike out boldly, a person has to feel that his rear is defended, that he has support on both his flanks, that there is solid earth beneath his feet. All these conditions were absent for the Article 58. Having passed through the meat grinder of political interrogation, the human being was physically crushed in body. He had been starved, he hadn't slept, he had frozen in punishment cells, he had lain there a beaten man. But it wasn't only his body. His soul was crushed, too. Over and over he had been told and had demonstrated to him that his views and his conduct in life and his relationships with people had all been wrong because they had brought him to ruin. All that was left in that scrunched-up wad the engine room of the law had spewed out into the prisoner transport was a greed for life, and no understanding whatever. To crush him once and for all, and to cut him off from all others once and for all, that was the function of interrogation under Article 58. The convicted prisoner had to learn that his worst guilt out in freedom had been his attempt somehow to get together or unite with others by any route but the party organizer, the trade union organizer, or the administration. In prison, this fear went so far as to become fear of all kinds of collective action. Two voices uttering the same complaint, or two prisoners signing a complaint on one piece of paper. Gun-shy now, and for a good long time to come, of any and every kind of collaboration or unification, the pseudo-politicals were not prepared to unite, even against the thieves. Nor would they even think of bringing along a weapon, a knife or a bludgeon, for the Stolypin car or the transit prison. In the first place, why have one? And against whom? In the second place, if you did use it, then, considering the aggravating circumstance of your malevolent Article 58, you might be shot when you were retried. In the third place, even before that, your punishment for having a knife when they searched you would be very different from the thief's. For him to have a knife was mere misbehavior, tradition. He didn't know any better. But for you to have one was terrorism. Finally, many of the people imprisoned under Article 58 were peaceful people, very often elderly, too, and often ill, and they had gotten along all their lives with words and without resorting to fisticuffs, and they weren't any more prepared for them now than they had been before. Nor had the thieves ever been put through the same kind of interrogation. Their entire interrogation had consisted of two sessions, an easy trial and an easy sentence. And they wouldn't have to serve it out. They would be released ahead of time. Either they would be amnested, or else they would simply escape. V.I. Ivanov, now from Ukhta, got Article 162, thievery, 9 times, and Article 82, escape, 5 times, for a total of 37 years in prison, and he served out 5 to 6 years for all of them. Even during interrogation, no one ever deprived a thief of his legitimate parcels, consisting of abundant packages from the loot kept by his underworld comrades who were still on the loose. He never grew thin, was never weak for a single day, and in transit he ate at the expense of the innocent non-thieves, whom he called, in his own jargon, the fraiera, freyers, or innocents, or suckers. Freya is a blatnoi, underworld word, meaning non-thief, in other words, not a chelovek, human being with a capital letter. Well, even more simply, the Friera were all non-thief, non-underworld mankind. Not only did the articles of the code dealing with thieves and bandits not oppress the thief, he was, in fact, proud of his convictions under them. And he was supported in this pride by all the chiefs in blue shoulder boards and blue piping. Oh, that's nothing. Even though you're a bandit and a murderer, you are not a traitor of the motherland. You are one of our own people. You will reform. There was no Section 11 for organization in the thieves' article in the code. Organization was not forbidden the thieves. And why should it be? Let it help develop in them the feelings of collectivism that people in our society need so badly. And disarming them was just a game. They weren't punished for having a weapon. Their thieves' law was respected. They can't be anything but what they are. And a new murder in the cell would not increase a murderer's sentence, but instead would bring him new laurels. And all that went very deep indeed. In works of the last century, the lumpen proletariat was criticized for little more than a certain lack of discipline, for fickleness of mood. And Stalin was always partial to the thieves. After all, who robbed the banks for him? Back in 1901, his comrades in the party and in prison accused him of using common criminals against his political enemies. From the 20s on, the obliging term social ally came to be widely used. That was Makarenko's contention, too. These could be reformed. According to Makarenko, the origin of crime lay solely in the counter-revolutionary underground. Those were the ones who couldn't be reformed. Engineers, priests, SRs, Mensheviks. And why shouldn't they steal if there was no one to put a stop to it? Three or four brazen thieves working hand in glove could lord it over several dozen frightened and cowed pseudo-politicals. With the approval of the administration, on the basis of the progressive doctrine. But even if they didn't drive off the thieves with their fists, why didn't the victims at least make complaints? After all, every sound could be heard in the corridor, and a convoy guard was marching slowly back and forth right out there. Yes, that is the question. Every sound and every complaining cry can be heard, and the convoy just keeps marching back and forth. Why doesn't he interfere? Just a yard away from him, in the half-dark cave of the compartment, they are plundering a human being. Why doesn't the soldier of the government police interfere? For the very same reason. He, too, has been indoctrinated. Even more than that, after many years of favoring thieves, the convoy has itself slipped in their direction. The convoy has itself become a thief. From the middle of the 30s until the middle of the 40s, during that 10-year period of the thieves' most flagrant debauches and most intense oppression of the politicals, no one at all can recall a case in which a convoy guard intervened in the plundering of a political in a cell, in a railroad car, or in a Black Maria. But they will tell you of innumerable cases in which the convoy accepted stolen goods from the thieves and in return bought them vodka, snacks, sweeter than the rations, too, and smokes. The examples are so numerous as to be typical. The convoy sergeant, after all, hasn't anything either. He has his gun, his greatcoat roll, his mess tin, his soldier's ration. It would be cruel to require him to escort an enemy of the people in an expensive overcoat or chrome leather boots, or with a swag of luxurious city articles, and to reconcile himself to that inequality. Was not taking these things just one additional form of the class struggle, after all? And what other norms were there? In 1945 to 1946, when prisoners streamed in, not just from anywhere, but from Europe, and wore and had in their bags unheard-of European articles, even the convoy officers could not restrain themselves. Their service had kept them from the front, but at the end of the war it also kept them from the harvest of booty. And I ask you, was that just? And so, in these circumstances, the convoy guard systematically mixed the thieves and the politicals in each compartment of their Stolypin, not through lack of space for them elsewhere, and not through haste, but out of greed. And the thieves did not let them down. They stripped the beavers of everything, and then those possessions migrated into the suitcases of the convoy. A beaver, in the Blatnoi, underworld, jargon, was any rich zek who had trash, meaning good clothes, and bacilli, meaning fats, sugar, and other goodies. But what could be done if the beavers had been loaded in the Stolypin cars and the train was moving and there simply weren't any thieves at all? They simply hadn't put any aboard. What if they weren't being shipped out on prisoner transports that day, even from one of the stations along the way? This could and did happen. Several such cases are known. In 1947, they were transporting from Moscow to the Vladimir Central Prison a group of foreigners who had opulent possessions, as could be seen the very first time their suitcases were opened. At that point, the convoy itself began a systematic confiscation of their belongings right there in the railroad car. So that nothing should be missed, the prisoners were forced to undress down to their bare skin and to sit on the floor of the car near the toilet while their things were examined and taken away. But the convoy guard failed to take into account that they were taking these prisoners not to a camp, but to a genuine prison. On their arrival there, I.A. Korneyev handed in a written complaint describing exactly what had happened. They found the particular unit of convoy guards and searched them. Some of the things were recovered and returned to their owners, who also received compensation in money for those that weren't recovered. They say that the convoy guards got from 10 to 15 years. However, this is something that cannot be checked, and anyway, they would have been convicted under an ordinary non-political article of the code, and they wouldn't have had to spend a long time in prison. However, that was an exceptional case, and if he had managed to restrain his greed in time, the chief of the convoy would have realized that it was better not to get involved in it. And here is another, less complicated case, which probably means that it happened often. In August 1945, in the Moscow Novosibirsk Stolypin car, in which A. Susi was being transported, it turned out that there weren't any thieves, and the trip was a long one, and the Stolypins just crawled along at that time. Without hurrying in the least, all in good time, the convoy chief declared a search, one prisoner at a time in the corridor, with his things. Those summoned were made to undress in accordance with prison rules, but that wasn't why the search was being conducted, for each prisoner who had been searched was, in fact, put right back into his own crowded compartment, and any knife, anything forbidden, could simply have been passed from hand to hand. The real purpose of the search was to examine their personal articles, the clothes they were wearing, and whatever was in their bags. And right there, beside the bags, not in the least bored by the whole protracted search, the chief of the convoy guard, an officer, stood with a haughty poker face, with his assistant, a sergeant, beside him. Sinful greed kept trying to pop out, but the officer kept it hidden under a pretended indifference. It was the same situation as an old rake looking over little girls, but embarrassed by the presence of outsiders. Yes, and by that of the girls, too. And not knowing exactly how to proceed. How badly he needed just a few thieves. But there were no thieves in the transport. There were no thieves aboard, but there were individuals among the prisoners who had already been infected by the thief-laden atmosphere of the prison. After all, the example of thieves is instructive and calls forth imitations. It demonstrates that there is an easy way to live in prison. Two recent officers were in one of the compartments, Sanin from the Navy and Mereshkov. They were both 58s, but their attitudes had already changed. Sanin, with Mereshkov's support, proclaimed himself the monitor of the compartment and, through a convoy guard, requested a meeting with their chief. He had fathomed that haughtiness and its need of a pimp. This was unheard of, but Sanin was summoned and they had a chat somewhere. Following Sanin's example, someone in the second compartment also asked for a meeting, and that person was similarly received. And the next morning they issued not 20 ounces of bread, prisoner transport ration at the time, but no more than 9 ounces. They gave out the ration, and a quiet murmur began. A murmur, but in fear of any collective action, these politicals did not speak up. In the event, only one among them loudly asked the guard distributing the bread, "Citizen chief, how much does this ration weigh?" "The correct weight," he was told. "I demand a re-weighing. Otherwise I will not accept it," the dissatisfied prisoner declared loudly. The whole car fell silent. Many waited before beginning to eat their ration, expecting that theirs too would be re-weighed. And at that moment, in all his spotlessness, the officer appeared. Everyone fell silent, which made his words all the weightier and all the more irresistible. "Which one here spoke out against the Soviet government?" All hearts stopped beating. People will protest that this is a universal approach, that even out in freedom every little chief declares himself to be the Soviet government and just try to argue with him about it. But for those who are panicky, who have just been sentenced for anti-Soviet propaganda, the threat is more frightening. "Who is starting a mutiny over the bread ration?" the officer demanded.
This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.